In today's episode of Cinema Men,
I'm going to hit you with a fun one. Max's Neil, future Neil, comes back to this moment, to the algorithm situation. Neil has to start at a younger age to move into the future to become future Neil. So Neil would be younger for the present day protagonist. Do you like Tarantino or Nolan more?
Insanely different schools of thought. The music kind of takes over and you cannot hear the dude anymore.
Yes.
But you're seeing what Pattinson is looking at.
What other kind of tenet theories do we discuss? Is Nolan or Tarantino the better director? Is there any other possible way Nolan could play with time in his future films? Tune in to find out all that and more on today's episode of Cinema Men.
Welcome back to Mess with the Best, Die Like the Rest, your one-stop shop for all things movie and David Tennant and conception and whatnot. My name is Casey.
My name is Zane. And Casey, it's really interesting how I have had my eyes open to the fact that I remember hating Robert Pattinson when we lived in a Twilight world, but now he's right. Like all the rage, right?
He's dope as hell.
Yeah, he's a god among men right now. We don't even need him to be Batman. He's just doing everything right.
So basically explain why we're talking again. What's the deal?
Oh, because this is actually our first episode.
Yep.
This is what we've been doing, is going in reverse this whole time, much like the movie Tenet. Well, I started at episode 100 and have been going back to episode 1, and Casey started at episode 1, going forward to episode 100. So I guess actually this is episode 50, which is...
It's been a good run so
very,
far.
Very, very nice how that worked out for Tenet. I know that the numbers don't say this is episode 50, but this is where we are in our timeline, if that makes sense. If you haven't guessed yet, we're talking about the famous movie David Tennant.
Yep.
Made by
My
Chris
favorite
Nolan.
Villain in Jessica Jones.
Yep.
That's his best role, his most notable role, obviously.
What's the
that
movie?
Most people can...
What's the movie he does where he's a devil?
The show? Good Omens?
Good Omens, yes. That's the role I know him best from, where he has a beautiful love relationship with Michael Sheen.
Oh, I wish I had a beautiful love relationship with Michael Sheen. So the movie David Tennant,
mm-hmm.
It came out famously during the COVID epidemic,
right.
Or pandemic, whatever the heck. And it was kind of interesting because Christopher Nolan's obviously one of the few filmmakers that's really, really into the theatrical experience. He's always shooting his films on 70mm, IMAX, all that stuff.
Yeah.
He's shooting on film always, and his sound, we'll get into the sound later, but that might be like the only flaw in the movie, regrettably. But so when the movie came out, it didn't do very well in the box office, at least here in America, because America floundered the pandemic response and
correct.
No one was able to go outside without dying.
Right.
So it's like, I get where he's coming from, you know, off the bat. Like, I would want people to see my movie as well if I worked clearly as hard as he did on this, as he did.
So
like, you
hard.
Watched the special features, right?
Oh, I watched as much behind-the-scenes footage as I could find, yes.
Fucking fascinating. He's... And there's so much to talk about.
All right, before we... I'm just going to say a huge spoiler warning up front, because I'm sure we're going to spoil this movie through and through as we go through it.
Yeah.
And it's weird to tell where we do spoil stuff because, I guess here's your first spoiler. It's pretty much like the movie plays halfway and then plays back. But like they do it in a way that it doesn't feel like you just rewatched the first half of the movie again. But essentially you feel like, because the end scene is taking place at the exact same time as the opera scene in the very beginning. So, time-wise, they did end up back at square one. So, right off the bat, that's fascinating how the timeline in Tenet works.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that. What do you mean it took the... So the opera scene
the
in
opera,
the open...
The opera scene where the protagonist is raiding the opera house to, like, save all the citizens and get rid of the bombs and whatnot, and that's all... That's all happening. That is happening at the same time, apparently, as the ending where they are trying to get rid of the algorithm, or at least not let it destroy the entire world.
Oh my god, I did not put that together. So I've seen the movie twice now.
Okay, cool. I can
I
can fill you in on another thing that I thought was super cool.
Oh, please.
So, you know, at the very end, I guess we're going with spoilers right off the bat, like all the way in.
Sure, who cares?
You know, right at the end, Robert Pattinson's character, Neil, has the red thread on his backpack, and, like, the body jumps up in the cave and prevents the protagonist from being shot with the reverse bullet into the guy's head.
Right.
And later, when Neil's like, guess I'm the one that's supposed to go down there and open that door, right? Because I would be the only one that would be able to figure that out. And then they close up on the red thread again. And you're like, oh, here's this connection of that body was Neil this whole time. Here's how I can make that perfectly clear because of the red thread. In the opera house, the reverse bullet that goes off and when the protagonist's life is saved during the opera scene, there's a red thread on the backpack of the man that's running away. So Neil was there too.
I did pick up on that. I am perceptive enough to actually have seen that.
Very groovy.
But that's cool. Damn.
Yeah.
That just makes, honest to God, like these little details make me just want to watch the movie again. And that's kind of the thing that's so cool about it is that it is super friggin' rewatchable.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest reasons I wanted to talk about it, and I mentioned this to you, was we talked about how this film is so, so well written for everything to play out the way that it does as cleanly as it does. Because I think, exposition or not, they explain the concept of the movie so well within the movie that I did not feel lost watching the movie. And I think that a lot of the bad reviews that came out of it that I was reading were pretty much just saying they didn't understand the movie. And so it didn't seem like they understood it and disliked it. It pretty much was just like if they were confused and unwilling to comprehend what was happening.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's an unfortunate line. Like, obviously movies are... I don't know. Movies are mostly meant to be entertaining.
Sure, right? Yeah.
But they're also an art form, so it's kind of like, it's based on your perception of them. If you personally didn't understand it, you probably didn't enjoy it. But at the same time, I would argue it's an incredibly well-made movie, story aside, you know, visually. I thought the visual storytelling was immaculate, just the way they didn't explain anything visually, necessarily, but they did at the same time. Like when the, I don't even know what you would call it, the door that you enter and then it spins around
quote
and
unquote,
then you come out the other
side. Quote-unquote time machine that's not really a time machine.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So
the
time machine,
machine.
That whole sequence was so, I don't know, it just made sense. Everything clicked when I saw it in motion.
Which one?
Like they
the
had
one
described
at the airport
it.
Or the one where the protagonist is in the chair and Andre... So Sater is on the other side with the woman.
I'm gonna say when the protagonist is in the chair with the woman right before the middle of the movie hits.
Okay, yeah, and this is when he's like,
you know what I'm
saying,
like right.
So this is like right after the whole car chase scene.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very cool.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's super well set up.
This kind of movie where it's so high concept and so cerebral, you need. And the fact that the protagonist himself is utterly blind to everything from the get-go. Like, he does not know what's happening, and he's obviously the stand-in for the audience. He's the person that's like, explain shit to me so I can get it. And that's awesome, and that's fine. And I thought, yes, some of the exposition was a little bit blunt, but it needed to be? I don't know. Like, what other way could you do it? when people are still going to be like, this was confusing and I didn't get it. And that's totally fine if you didn't get it, but I don't know. That's not where I would find fault in this movie.
There's bluntness where it absolutely doesn't need to be blunt, and there's bluntness for a movie that gets this complicated. I think that's a good fine line to look at. Like, there's bluntness in a rom-com where you can very easily follow. Like, the problem with a rom-com is technically, you know, guy's going to meet girl. Halfway through the movie, there's going to be something where it looks like they're not going to work out. And at the end, they're going to work out. And that's just kind of how a rom-com works. So exposition in there feels unnecessary sometimes because you feel like you already understand the story ahead of time. Whereas in Tenet, you're going in and one of the first things that you see in the opera house without context is a bullet reversed back into a gun. And you think, I don't understand how that happened. Do they have, like, some material where he shot it and then could just bring it back in? And then they go further in to explain where he's like, oh, so they're using time travel to make this all. And someone's like, no. Time travel is not a thing here. And then this is also not a nuclear war that we're heading into. There is somebody, and this is how they explain it, and I love this. There was somebody who placed all of this stuff in a time capsule, buried it underground, and somebody in the future put it through that inverse machine so that instead of the bullet's momentum through time going from the present to the future, it's technically on that path now of going from the future back to the present, so its entropy is reversed. And that did need to be said straightforward for people to start understanding that later in the movie.
And that was very eloquently said, actually. That was a very good description of what happened.
Thank you.
In few words. Also, when you were explaining the first time that we really see the inverse gun mechanics in the opera house, it's also cued perfectly with the score.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? How the score, like, kind of twists and it's like, I don't know. I'm not going to try to do it with my voice, but damn, the score. So Hans Zimmer didn't actually do this. Hans Zimmer's obviously who Nolan typically works with, I'm pretty
especially
sure.
Especially for Dark Knight and Inception, for sure. Yes.
Yeah, and...
and Interstellar, yeah. For sure. Hans Zimmer is a big key cinematic name to have for a score, because
so this time he worked with Ludwig Göransson,
and at the end Travis Scott.
Oh, okay, yeah. I actually shut off the film before that song came on, but I'm sure it's great. Travis Scott's he's a pretty good dude. I just the way that the music cues with the time travel, or I don't want to call it time travel, the inversion.
Yeah.
Dear Lord, what a great, because like film is obviously like a very visual art form. Film is my favorite because of how it combines every form of art, visual, sound, acting, all that kind of stuff. And I thought this movie friggin' nailed it in all those capacities, except for when the sound was a little too blisteringly loud.
Okay.
And there was this one scene, and I'm not sure if this is on purpose, and I'm pretty sure it was, because I'm pretty sure it was from Pattinson's point of view.
Okay.
When he's down surveying the art, the art security place in the basement of the airport thing.
Yeah.
I am at a literal loss for words right now. I don't know why I can't.
Now I see what you're talking about. The where all the art's stored. Yeah.
Yeah, so as the man who's leading Robert Pattinson through that is explaining what the building's all about, the music kind of takes over, and you cannot hear the dude anymore, but you're seeing what Pattinson is looking at. So I think...
That had to be intentional. They were trying to say, stop worrying about this man's words, understand that Pattinson is not focused on actually his words at this point. I assumed that was an audio cue to tell the audience... from Neil's perspective, we don't care about what this guy is saying right now at all. We only care about what Neil is seeing, because it was no longer, because he needed explanation of the when the fire alarms go off, it doesn't release water, it releases whatever kind of gas that it within 10 seconds suffocates humans. And so after getting that information, he was more focused on like the doorways and where the artwork was and everything. It was anytime they were actually describing like, this is the artwork, this is the architecture of this building is from wherever or something like that, that becomes a moot point that I guess Nolan really wants to intensify, making sure his audience does not get caught up in, since it's unnecessary information.
Damn, okay, yeah, as I was saying it out loud, I started to realize, wait, actually, that's kind of brilliant, because it's... Because, like, I don't know about you, but when this movie came out and people were seeing it in theaters, obviously not many, but when people were and they were reviewing it, they were mentioning how the sound design was kind of poor because a lot of the dialogue was drowned out. But now I'm actually taking that back, because I think, I don't know if it's because of the Blu-ray copy I have or something, but I don't know. I thought it actually sounded fine.
Yeah. I mean,
hindsight now, thank you.
I know a good amount of people that said like Christopher Nolan does it again, but his sound design is bad again. And I think a lot of the time that the sound design, the peak moments where people would express distaste for or disdain for the sound design, I think it's intentional. Or certainly, I mean, there's certain intention behind it. I don't think he's upping the music for the sake of intensity. I think he's upping the music for the sake of changing your focus. Like that, like I said before, I think the purpose is to make sure that you're not focused on what the guy that's giving the tour of the base is saying in that moment. Because, he's taken a lot of little things into account in this film. And I mean a lot. And I got so hooked. I got more hooked on this film once I started looking into little things in the background. And I mean, this is another thing that I liked. This is just a minor fact to start off. Talking about the score. I mean, there were times that I really did like that you could hear where it was like ticking strings. And then at some point it sounded like it was like, and then it starts warping backwards or something, and it kind of is another visual ride of, or an audio ride of like how the time is starting to move differently within the film. Underlying in all of the score, there's a breathy tone, and it is actually Christopher Nolan breathing in and out.
And are you serious?
And they put it into the score, yeah.
That's similar to how Dunkirk had the stopwatch all throughout the movie, mm-hmm. which is his father's stopwatch
I think something. So there's
like his father or grandfather's.
It's always something so.
It's
interesting.
Very interesting. God, he's a really goddamn interesting director, and I'm super glad he's working.
Oh,
you know,
my it's gosh, like same.
like watching Tenet and watching Inception a few weeks ago. I don't know, dude. I'm so on board. I love this dude.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the... It's funny, actually. My least favorite Nolan movies are the Batman movies. And that's probably, like, heresy, I'm sure.
No, I mean, I think that's fine. Like, Dark Knight is, I think, so critically acclaimed because of how in contrast it is to any other kind of, or at least for a long time, any kind of superhero film that you would see. You'd be like, wow, you went the route of like Game of Thrones-esque, anybody could die here, and the psychopath isn't just like, I'm gonna blow up the sun. They're like, no, I just want to see people kill themselves for the fun of it. And you're like, that is very dark. And people are like, well, that's what the Joker's like. And you don't make Batman a hero. You make him like, well, he's a cocky billionaire who probably has dirty money from his parents, and he's going against the law, and he refuses to kill the criminals even though he beats up every single person he meets and hangs them by wires everywhere. And you're like, dang, this man's just as much of a threat as the Joker is, except for some reason we kind of trust him. And
yeah,
I think when it comes to what's the first one? Which one is his? Batman Begins?
Yeah, Batman Begins.
Yeah, that one. See, if you say you don't like that, or you think that's his least quality movie, I completely get it.
Yeah, Batman Begins suffers from being... arguably an action movie, mm-hmm. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no, I don't even know if you could argue that. It's more of a
setup,
a drama. I don't know. But all the, I don't know, just all the action in it is shot so poorly that you can't even see what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's like huge to me. I'm a huge visual movie watcher, so if I can't make out the action in your fucking comic book movie, that's a huge problem.
Right.
Thankfully, that was solved in The Dark Knight. And the only issue I have with The Dark Knight is that it's paced a little wonkily.
I get that.
I'm not a huge fan of the midway point. It just kind of slows way down, whereas everything before that was just ramped up and super energetic. And then Dark Knight Rises, honest to God, I think that's my favorite of the trilogy.
It's, I think people didn't like it because of the Heath Ledger falling out at that point.
Yeah,
and when I say falling out, just to be clear, I'm not saying like something bad, like he had a dispute with right. other people. It's the fact that people adored him so much and that they wanted him to be in the sequel so badly, and Nolan even intended
how dare
to have
he die.
Him. There was some kind of hate within everybody's mourning there, I think, of where they were like, well, in honor of Heath Ledger, I will not like this next movie because he's not in it, or something like that. But I think Christopher Nolan absolutely did a fantastic job with Bane, considering that Bane doesn't, at least from anything that I've experienced in games or comics with Bane, I never got this huge thought that he could be this like destroy the entire city type of guy. I see him as a bad guy, right? But I see him like the Rhino in Spider-Man. I'm like, he's a big guy, I'll break buildings. I don't see the Rhino.
Paul Giamatti.
I don't see Paul Giamatti any day soon being like, all right, I can take down all of New York City. No, but they did very well with it. And I think something that Christopher Nolan does very well in general, and he mentioned this in a Tenet interview, is he always makes sure that he has some construct of the ending of a film when he has the beginning of it too, so that when he gets into writing the film, he already has an idea from the beginning of where he wants to go, and then he can see where it goes, as opposed to just being like, I'm gonna make a Batman film, where do we start? He'd be like, all right, this is kind of where I want it to end up, which is fantastic, so that he doesn't get so lost in his work. He kind of has this subtle backbone from the beginning. Great. But B, he intends to challenge himself with every single movie, which is A, I think something that's fantastic in any kind of filmmaker or writer or anything. But B, he's successful at it. I would say he's successful. When you see,
I would say so.
When you see Inception and Interstellar and Tenet, and you think, this, you're not just saying like, oh, I'm making Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, and I'm making the heists a little different. You're like, oh, no, I'm going to start with Dreams Within Dreams Within Dreams. Then I'm going to study the concept of time slowing down and speeding up within space. And then I'm going to talk about inversion and the fact that somehow you could be interacting with time, interacting with people that are moving on the same timeline, just in the opposite direction. You're like, these are massively like genuine challenges to yourself, and he's doing so well with it.
Yeah, no, he's definitely doing well. He's like the most interesting genre filmmaker out there, because he takes very standard ideas and makes them absolutely fascinating. You know, Inception is a heist movie, but
yeah.
It's a heist movie with dreams. Tenet, we haven't even mentioned, is a spy movie.
Yeah.
And it's not even really about the time stuff, technically. It's about, you know, the spy going out and doing his mission. It's
right.
His version of the James Bond movie. But he does it in the most fascinating, brilliant way imaginable. What else is there? Memento is basically a noir,
I
would say.
Yes.
Only told in reverse.
Yeah. Except for the black and white. That was, I guess, an early stage concept of him playing with the idea of working with a timeline going one direction while another goes the other direction. Because isn't that's how it works? Kind of the black and white's kind of catching up to where the story is being told from the short-term memory loss flashbacks.
Yeah, basically. Nice. That's a good one. I haven't seen that in many, many years. Same. But I recall it being really good.
Oh, it is. Oh, man. Oh, you just reminded me of more and more reasons to love this guy.
Yeah, so basically that's what I'm super duper into. It's just the fact that he's able to take these genres and then just inject so much life and creativity into them.
You know what gave me mad respect for him a long time ago and gave me even more respect for him when I realized how it works within this film, Tenet. So previously, when he had made Dark Knight, I was already obsessed with the fact that it was shot in and around Chicago, at least pieces. And the truck flip scene, the iconic truck flip scene, the stuntman that he worked with to legitimately flip that entire truck in Dark Knight, that's practical. That's not CGI. That happened.
Right. That's, same with the plane scene in the beginning of Dark Knight Rises.
That's these are amazing. The fact that you're like, wait, so he could do this on a lot. He could do this with green screen. He could get motion effects to do this and stuff. No, he did it. And that is why it looks the way it does, is because it's real. And that's, I think, the beauty in Tenet too, because let's start simple, right? There's the car chase and the reverse car coming down. They shut down a street in, I can't remember which country they were in, but I think Estonia, wherever they were, and don't quote me on Estonia, but wherever they were, they shut it down for 3 weeks. They shot that entire scene multiple times forwards and multiple times backwards. They genuinely drove cars forwards and backwards. And Robert Pattinson was also genuinely driving when he was in the car he was in.
Yeah, he did a lot of stunt driving for himself in this movie, and I thought he did a fantastic job.
That scene, and knowing that like kind of actually happened the way it happened, amazing. I was already obsessed with the fact that the fight scenes were the way they were. They shot them forwards and they shot them backwards. They had them doing backflips and running backwards and everything to. They shot every a bunch of these scenes forwards and backwards it looks so good to
now. To be clear, when you're saying they shot it forward and backwards, you're saying the actors learned how to
run backwards, talk backwards,
doing the easy route and
reversing the footage,
just taking the film and literally reversing it.
Right. They just changed the sound design to reversed. For specifically, like, if people were running in reverse, they would change that sound design and reverse it. But if other stuff around it was moving forward, that sound design would still be moving forward. And so there's a scene, like, when they're running Kat, the main girl, on the gurney into the ambulance or whatever. There's a whole thing of, like, if you watch it forwards and backwards, you can see kind of like, oh, they actually started like here and ran backwards to there. And it's just it looks so good. But on top of how many things in this film look so good, even though you'd think they had such simpler ways of doing it, one of the most phenomenal things, I think, is the fact that 747 crashing into a real, working live airport was 100% real.
Yeah, they had to grab a defunct 747 from some like airplane graveyard, and because it was cheaper than doing it in CG, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, which is wild because it was like half their budget. No, sorry, half their budget went to maintaining the yacht that they shot on. That's what it was.
Oh my god, yeah. Well, you brought up Kat a moment ago,
yep.
And I think here's one way that I think Nolan can improve a little bit as a writer.
Okay.
She was supposedly the heart of the film.
Yeah.
You know, in some aspects, she's trying to, you know, be with her son. She's trying to kind of get over the fact that her husband's a disgusting monster, who, by the way, played by Kenneth Branagh. He had to learn how to speak in a Russian accent backwards.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know if you picked up on that at all, but that's just brilliant in its own right.
Because, like, I already knew that this sounds weird. I mean, I best know him as the main detective in Murder on the Orient Express. Like, that was
I was hoping you would say, like, Hamlet or something.
No, I mean, just because this is the most, the Orient Express is the most recent thing that I had seen him in. And I already knew that he had, like, a wonderful British accent. And I was already impressed by the fact of, like, how well he was doing with the Russian accent. It completely slipped my mind that I was like, oh, this is a British man doing a Russian accent and has to do it in reverse, too. That's nuts.
Yeah, he actually spoke his lines in reverse with the Russian accent as well, which is fascinating. Anyway, sorry, back to Kat. I just had to bring
that
up.
No, yeah.
One of the worst lines of dialogue in the entire movie is when Robert Pattinson is basically explaining to them in after she gets shot. They're basically explaining that the whole world is going to fucking, you know, cease to exist if they don't go through with this plan.
Okay.
And she says, including my son?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah, the whole world. Not your son's not, oh my God, I hated that line so bad.
No, she doesn't, if I'm not mistaken, well, actually, double down on this, because you watched this, even though I watched it only a couple days ago, you've watched it more recently than me. She says it as a statement, not a question, right? She says, including my son. I thought I remembered her saying it, not asking it. If she asks it, no matter what, it's dumb. But I just, like, I get it. I get it to the degree of, like, her emphasizing her care for her son of, like, she doesn't really care about what happens to the rest of the world. She just wants her son to be okay. But no matter what, the line didn't necessarily have to be there. But it's not it doesn't, like, ruin anything.
Do we even see the son's face?
Yes. Yes. Especially at the end. Yeah.
Because this is the thing that you're supposed to care about, and he never lets you care about it.
I have a couple things to say about the son. But yeah, you know, that's really interesting. I only remember seeing the son's face at the end, and much like Inception, you only ever see the kids' faces at the end.
But there was a reason for that.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people mention in Inception that they're like, the top never stops spinning, so did he wake up? Actually, the totem was really his wedding ring. If that wasn't on, then he was woken up. No, like, guys, he can't see his kids' faces in his dreams. He can see his kids' faces at the end. He's awake. It's good. He woke up. Where do you stand on what I just said?
I am a little hazy on it, mostly because I can't decide necessarily.
He can't get his kids to turn around in his dreams.
They do
at the end.
Is it established how long he's been away from his children, though? Because they look the exact same age at the very end as they do in the dream.
Although, I mean, that's true, but at the same time, if we've established anything within Christopher Nolan films, a lot of time could pass within depth of dreams. He could spend a day at a level of a dream in his head and actually only lose about 5 minutes in real world time.
Okay. I'm mostly focusing on real world time, though.
No, I'm just saying, like,
he has to get his team together and they have to go do all that planning and
stuff.
He
might have been away from his kids,
like,
max a half a year or something. Like, who knows? Probably not. But at the same time, you bring up a good point. It is kind of odd that his kids look the exact same. Sure.
I mean, I am of the camp that wants him to be awake at the very end.
Yeah.
That he's back with his family and that everything worked out perfectly fine. Because, dear Lord, I'd rather that than the cynical ending where, oh, good, my mom killed herself. My dad's in some fucking coma on an airplane right now. Who goddamn knows?
Yeah.
Saving Ken Watanabe. I don't know. I'd rather the optimistic approach to the end of that film.
Now let me hit you with a very interesting approach to the end of Tenet. This is one of my favorite theories that I've come across so far, and I've looked into it as much as I can, that I am fully on board with this being the reality. Yes, we see, as far as I remember, we do see the kid's face at the end. little Maximilian there, walking away with his mom. Protagonist saves them and then presumably runs off to go talk to her and the kid and whatnot. I'm going to hit you with something real good.
Well, he's still in the pincer, though, at the very end. He's still in the mission.
Yeah. Yeah, he kills off Priya at the end, right? And then, presumably, from how this timeline works and whatnot, because this is the first mission for him of whatever. But then as time goes on, he's going to be, like, the leader of Tenet and send Neil in the future back to meet up with him at the beginning to stop everything so that everything happens the way it does. I'm going to hit you with a fun one. Max is Neil.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I got things. I got things.
Please.
Well, here's the biggest reach, right? Maximilian, the end of Maximilian reversed is Neil.
What? What?
The end of Maximilian, because the kid's name is Max. Maximilian, spell it all the way out. Reverse it. Neil.
Is his name Maximilian or is his name Max?
Well, his name is Max, but it could be. I mean, to be fair, I haven't actually looked up on Letterboxd if they give him credit as Maximilian, but it's safe to say that Max is short for Maximilian, because it is. I think it usually always is. And the Seder Square is a big, big thing in this film, because there's Andres. The Seder Square, if you don't know what I'm talking about, is there's this old square that had a bunch of palindromes on them, and the middle palindrome is the word Tenet. And then Seder is a word on there, which is the main villain, Andre Seder. The word Arepo is on there, and I'm pretty sure that's either the artist or the artwork that is, like, being held over the girl's head. Opera is on there, and the opera house is the whole experience. And then Rhodus is on there. And I don't remember exactly where Rhodus comes in, but I know it's on the black and yellow ship. I know there's, like, a crate that says Rhodus on it. So they have the whole Seder Square stuff in there. Everything being forwards and backwards in that film, I mean, obviously, is like a... It makes sense. And I do believe they only credit him as Max, but that's fine. That was the smallest possible thread.
I like the idea. That's cool.
So other than that, Neil does say to the protagonist, because the protagonist keeps saying, like, how the hell do you know so much? Neil says... if we're alive at the end of this and you still really want to know, come to me and I'll tell you my life story. There's a presumption that when he runs off to talk to the girl and the kid, that is the beginning of the telling of the life story. Then we get to the stuff that makes a little bit more sense, such as future Neil comes back to this moment, to the algorithm situation. Neil has to start at a younger age to move into the future to become future Neil. So Neil would be younger for the present day protagonist. Okay. So that kid and the protagonist at... So Max and the protagonist at their ages make sense for old future protagonist and Max to turn into the Neil that we see. Neil is very, very caring for Kat throughout the movie for a lot of it. Right? He's not a doctor, but he's looking over the girl. He's not complaining every time the protagonist wants to, like, look after the girl. So there's a chance that there's mother-son love there in some way. The biggest one that makes sense to me is Neil, before he's going to go die at the end of the movie, go down to the hole and die, he turns to the protagonist and says, are you going to go check up on that girl? And the protagonist says, no. And then Neil says, not even from afar? The protagonist says, no. Well, the only people that were there during that scene at the end, when the protagonist does end up going to check on the girl from afar, were the protagonist, Priya, who dies, Kat, and her son, Max.
Interesting. That is that's cool. I like that idea.
That being said,
no one intended that.
I was gonna say, I don't know if it was intended. I don't know if, I mean, he's done a lot of things in his film that were intentional, like giving people moving forwards red colors to wear, and giving people that were moving invertedly blue colors, to connect with the Doppler effect. So there are little things that are obviously intentional throughout his film.
Thought that was just like a really good visual cue for the viewers so they don't get too confused by all the action taking place.
I mean, it is, for sure. Like, especially with the scene where the protagonist is talking to Sater through the glass, and Sater's in a blue room and the protagonist is in a red room. I mean, yeah, it is. It's a very good visual color line between them. But yeah, their time is moving differently. And there are even subtle things of like the car chase scene where Kat's like stuck in the reverse car heading into traffic. She's wearing red because she's still moving forward, even though she's in an inverted car.
Oh, cool. That's a good eye.
So there are some subtle things like that everywhere. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Neil being Max was intentional. And obviously that's still just a speculation, but it's one that's got some kind of little details in it that very well could have been intentional by Christopher Nolan.
That's very cool. I like that a lot. I hope that is I hope that is accurate. I mean, I don't know how accurate this is, but I thought I heard some rumblings about a sequel.
Named Inception?
Oh, no. Well, Inception... I would never want a sequel for Inception. That shit's like perfect.
Yeah.
Like, that's, honest to God, Inception's like a very close to a perfect movie in my eyes.
I don't know.
This is really good.
I don't know how. I mean, I see people saying that these films, Tenet and Inception, some people say, oh, Tenet's the sequel to Inception. Some people just say that's obviously not true. It kind of feels like they're in the same family tree, sure. And right. Then there are other people that say, I mean, they don't even play with time in the same way, so that doesn't really make sense. But
it's just like thematically, and it's like, I don't know, spiritual sequel possibly, but that's not even accurate either. Like, I don't think putting the word sequel anywhere near these movies makes any sense.
I mean, what would they, this is the problem, what would they, how would they make a sequel to Tenet and keep the beauty of the discovering along the way alive? Because, oh, this was the other thing I was going to mention. Practical effects-wise, like I mentioned to you, when he holds his hand over a bullet and it flies up into his hand, that shot's not reversed. They have strings. Yeah, they have strings on the glove that he's wearing that pull the bullet or pull whatever up into his hand. So that's shot forward. That actually just happens. I don't see how they could make it like, we discover the inversion. We discover... That woman that Kat was jealous of her freedom diving off the boat, that was her. We discover that Sater, they needed to give Sater the algorithm so that his past self thought that the algorithm that his plan worked, so that his future self wouldn't be suspicious of Kat being back on the boat. There are these things that were beautiful discoveries, even when we find out that the protagonist was fighting himself in the airport, and that both of those guys that came out were both him, because that's how that can work. That's amazing. This, like, it's so many little things like that. Sure, there could be a spy thing that plays with the concepts of Tenet in a sequel, but the discovery of all of those moments in the moment wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, you're right. In terms of having a satisfying conclusion, I don't know, every story beat is incredibly satisfying. Whenever you find out something new about the world, whenever you find out more information about inversion, how it works visually, how it works, you know, all that shit is super frigging awesome. And I just loved I just loved the ride. It felt like it was paced super well.
It,
you know,
yeah.
Like, very rarely, if any, dull moments, I would say. It's 2.5 hours. It's not short, but it's like dear Lord, is it wears its time incredibly well, and it never wastes any of it, ironically.
So Christopher Nolan has played with time on the X, Y, and Z axis at this point, yeah. Right? He's played back and forth on the X axis in Tenet. He's played on the Y axis in Interstellar, and he played with the Z axis in Inception. There's something that's beautiful about Tenet, which is all of it, and then there's something that sucks, and that is, man, it's gonna be hard not to want more from Christopher Nolan. You know, I mean, you see Inception and you think this is amazing, and then he makes Interstellar and you're like, he can do this twice, and then and then you see Tenet and you're like, oh my God, can this guy just keep going? I mean, if he makes another like Dunkirk, you'd be like, do it Tenet again. Don't show me Tom Hardy understandable in a plane for half an hour. Give me Tenet.
I love Dunkirk though.
See, that's the thing. Dunkirk's not a bad film. I think it just gets a bad rep because of where it came out in Christopher Nolan's filmography timeline.
Does it get a bad rep?
Yeah, for sure, for the sound design.
Oh, well, that's annoying.
I mean, like, you can't understand Tom Hardy at all, and you paid him all this money to never see his face.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, he has some of the most expressive eyes in Hollywood, so I mean,
that's fair. That's fair. Plus, it's not like we're not used to seeing him wear a mask in a Nolan film, so.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Dunkirk fucking slaps. I saw that in 70mm and IMAX when I was in theaters, so, like, I got the best experience imaginable out of that movie. So maybe that's why I'm absolutely in love with it. But
I remember really liking it. I know a lot of people didn't like the fact that, and this is another thing that bothers me, is when it's just a little bit too nitpicky. People just gave it 1 out of 5 stars just because Harry Styles was in it.
What? He was great. He gave an awesome performance.
Yeah, but then, like, just the fact that he's in it would make it. It's like if you went into, and hear me out with what I say, it's like if you went into an Adam Sandler film and you were just like, well, this is 1 out of 5 stars because Adam Sandler's in it. And then all of a sudden, it's Uncut Gems and you're like, well, this isn't that bad.
Well, that's the same line of thinking that's not criticism. That's literally blocking your eyes and ears and yelling into the void. That's not criticism. People's opinions, if that's what you could even call them, are not interesting
in the way of being willing to experience the film for what it is.
Yeah, so I don't know. If anyone is actually listening to those kinds of people, that's, I guess, unfortunate and upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I don't know. Figure it out, you fucking coward.
Yeah.
But Dunkirk does play with time. It plays with time in that there's three different settings all converging on one conclusion, I suppose. I don't know.
How can he play with time again? Let's see if you can predict. So he's moved forwards and backwards. He's moved in and out. He's stretched it. So the same timeline is slower, depending on how, like, far from Earth and different gravities that you're experiencing in different worlds. And then he's also played with it in the idea of three stories being told at the exact same time.
Yeah.
How else can he play with time?
Oof. I'm not smart, so I don't know. I'm the very wrong person to ask. I'm shocked that, well, are there any films that he doesn't play with time? I'm pretty sure his first film, he doesn't really play with time very much at all. The Batman movies, obviously, but that's their own thing.
I mean, to a degree, he plays with time in the sense of there being a race against the clock in the Dark Knight series. Although, to be fair, you're supposed to, in any kind of action film, there's supposed to be some quote-unquote race against the clock. There's got to be some...
Isn't that just called motivation?
Yeah, there's got to be some drive to the film. Because it'd be like, if in Tenet, if the entire world wasn't going to end and it was just going to be a bomb in one spot, the movie wouldn't be as huge, right? If he was like just going to blow up a building, you'd be like, all of this. I mean, I think like that's kind of why it had to be the entire world was going to end. You're like, you introduced the entire concept of inverting entropy just to stop like the Empire State Building from coming down. That's a lot. So it had to be the reward had to be huge. Oh, you saved the entire world. Well done. See, Inception plays with time. Dark Knight plays with time. Interstellar. Yep. Dunkirk. Tenet. The Prestige. He plays with the concept of teleportation.
Yeah, I...
And cloning.
I don't think I would put that with... in the same realm at all, really.
Okay, okay.
I think that was just a cool mystery.
Oh, that was stuff that he was a producer on. Oh, is this for real? I didn't know this. This is a discovery for me. He was a producer on Batman v Superman?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, okay.
I mean, he just put his money towards it. He also produced Man of Steel. I think that's just his working relationship with DC and Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Man, it's very interesting. You'd think that he's played with... You'd think that Christopher Nolan's made a lot of films. I mean, he's certainly made a good handful, but, like, I was surprised to see this list isn't that big.
Well, also, look at the years. Like, he's only been around for, what, 20... 25-ish years as a working director. So it's like, Following is his first film, and Following's okay. His first feature.
Huge, okay, yeah, first feature, yeah.
And obviously with anyone's first feature, it's not going to be as chiseled and well-refined as his later work. But the fact that he followed up Following with Memento just shows that, dear Lord, this dude's brain is immense.
Well, so on here, what we've got, yeah, Following. He also made a movie that I still haven't seen and really want to, Insomnia, with Al Pacino and Robin Williams.
That's actually a remake of I'm pretty sure a Swedish film.
Oh my gosh. And then on here, we also get three short films from Christopher Nolan. Doodlebug.
Right.
And then there's also Quay. And
Quay?
Larceny. And these are all 1996, 1997. Up to...
Yeah, so see, he's been directing for as long as I've been alive. That's not a very long time at all, especially when you think the time between The Dark Knight and Inception was 2 years.
Yeah.
That's crazy. 2 years to make Inception, the movie where they literally made a set so that the hallway was able to turn all the way around.
That, yes.
Like all this kind of stuff, like, I get what you're saying. It definitely feels like he's directed more stuff, but also the amount of quality he has put out is like, whoa, that's pretty crazy.
I think, the only... you know what's really... Oh, wait, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, because I'm a dick writer for Paul Thomas Anderson, but, like, the only other person I can think of that, like, single-handedly almost... I hate the word auteur. I fundamentally disagree with the auteur theory, frankly, but the only person similar in my eyes could be, like, PTA or, like, Tarantino or something, you know, people that just... constant quality whenever they put stuff out. And I'm sure I sound like the biggest film boy in the fucking world right now, but I don't know, whatever.
Here's something I want to throw at you, see if it sticks. Do you like Tarantino or Nolan more?
Insanely different schools of thought.
I think that Tarantino certainly focuses on the script of his, like, the literal wording of how his story is told more. I think Nolan heavily focuses on the audience's experience more.
I think Nolan's more interested in story, whereas Tarantino's more interested in character. You don't get nearly as many delightful dialogue sequences in Nolan's movies, because
no.
I don't think he's a very good writer of dialogue, frankly.
Okay, yeah.
But Tarantino is able to really excel. Basically, Tarantino comes from the school of, like, grindhousey B-movie kind of, like, schlock crap, and he just mm-hmm. sort of refines it into a very digestible mainstream ideal. Like, look at... I watched Inglourious Bastards fairly recently. That movie's absolutely fantastic, and...
Oh, yeah.
The reason it's great is because of all the dialogue sequences, and because, I don't know. There's... getting into Tarantino now, 55 minutes in, not the best idea.
No.
That's an entire other episode. Because I have a love-hate relationship with Tarantino. I think that
Same.
He is a little too... He steals ideas way too much. Like, if you watch Kill Bill before you watch Lady Snowblood... you're probably going to be like, whoa, Lady Snowblood's really similar and familiar. Well, no, Lady Snowblood came out in 1970s, and it's a brilliant Japanese revenge film. And then you watch Kill Bill, and it's like, oh, wow, this is literally the same story, just told through a different lens, kind of.
Gotcha.
So it's like, he just basically takes old things and revives it. So in a way, I'm happy that he's reviving it. I'm happy that there's someone out there basically... bringing attention to these older films that American audiences probably have not been, you know, introduced to before, and actually presenting them in a way that they can be, I don't know, enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that, I mean, the more I think about it now, the more I think on the page, words coming out of the characters' mouths, I think that Tarantino does a significantly better job than Nolan, whereas visually I am far more entertained and immersed through Nolan's films.
Well, what's funny is that the people that we're talking about right now all write their own movies. They all direct,
yep.
obviously, their own movies.
Yep.
And they all utilize actual stock film with their stuff. And Nolan's movies, I think it's just in film is really dependent on lighting, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
okay.
You can, if you light a movie poorly, it's just going to look digital. You're not going to be able to tell that it's literally film. Whereas if you light it with big, huge lights, big, like classical kind of Hollywood stuff like PTA does, you're going to really get some texture out of your picture, and it's going to look delicious. And that's
yep.
what Tarantino and PTA do super duper well. Like, watch Phantom Thread. Oh my god, that fucking movie is sumptuous. It's delicious. It's so good. And it's all in the visuals of it, you know, because it's like that film texture is just, oh, it's something else. It's so great. And you see it so little, unfortunately, mostly because it's friggin' expensive.
Yeah.
You know, I watched this movie the other day called The Love Witch from this director, Anna Biller, I want to say her name is.
Okay.
Fantastic, fantastic voice she has. She's absolutely incredible. It's this awesome throwback to like Technicolor 60s movies. It's like funny, it's grim, it's weird, it's utterly crazy, and I highly recommend it to everyone because it's just, it's an entirely new experience that you can't really describe. And I think we need more shit like that, you know?
I think it's very hard to convince yourself as a writer, to take a step back from anything that you start writing and really acknowledge the difference between where your script is going because it's a story that you're excited to tell versus where your script is going because you think that it's a story that hasn't been told before.
Yeah.
Because I think... a lot of the times some directors or some writers, not a lot of the top tier ones, but a lot of people might fall into a pitfall because they think that they're like, it could be as simple as like the people that wrote the Jurassic World films being like, oof, we've never seen the dinosaurs in water before. And you're like, well, we didn't have to.
Literally probably came up in the writer's room.
You didn't make the film better. A lot of it, it's like... a lot of it can come across as in a pop song, a lot of the verses are bad filler to get to the catchy chorus. And so in Jurassic World, you might get a lot of bad context and bad setup to get to the T-Rex saving the day. And you're like, well, that was a lot of setup to get to a 10-second punchline, man. Like,
right, especially when the punchline, sort of, so to speak, is literally just nostalgia bait, and it's something that you... There are no new ideas. I'm not ignorant to that. There are no new ideas. I get it. And every idea on screen or in a book or in a play or whatever has been done before. It's just dependent on how you do it again. And like,
you gotta experience it in a new light. And as opposed to, like, somebody could probably remake Tenet or remake the concept of Tenet. It just can't be stopping a Russian from trying to blow up the entire world. Like, that you can tell it maybe in a film noir setting instead of a spy movie setting, and all of a sudden, like, it all of a sudden feels like an entirely different film. And you're like, well, part of that reminded me of Tenet, but it's not like so similar that you're upset that it feels like it's a ripoff almost. Like, he played with the time, with the short-term memory time in Memento. I feel like I could find a way to connect Memento to Inception pretty easily, because it feels like this mind fuck of like, is he living in the moment right now? Is he chasing me or am I chasing him? Am I awake or am I asleep? Like, there's a fine similarity there, and I'm sure there's some kind of similarity there because they came from the same mind writing those scripts. But he found a different goal and found a way to make those two stories be told entirely differently, being the difference between a heist movie and this noir detective vibe. I've never been more re-excited and revamped to want to write a script than I have been recently after just watching Tenet.
Hell yeah, good. That's the shit, dude. Don't let imposter syndrome bring you down. That's the whole thing. Like, when I said there are no new ideas, that kind of shit always keeps people down. That's the whole thing with imposter syndrome. You know, am I good enough? Is this just the same rehash over and over again? It doesn't matter if the idea that you're working off of is something similar to something else. It's all dependent on how you do it and how you actually put it into action. So, hell yeah.
That being said, to go back to Tenet. We touched on quite a few things in Tenet, such as the practical effects, some of the possible is Neil the son.
Yeah, that's fun. I like that idea a lot.
The connection of the red thread, the connection of the Doppler effect throughout the film, the connection of the Seder Square. Are there any other little things? It doesn't have to be as complicated as a certain like subject like those. Are there any like little scenes where you're just like, this moment in this film, I cannot get out of my head?
Not necessarily a moment. I was gonna mention the cinematographer, because I if you can't tell, you're more of a script guy. I'm more of a visuals kind of. I don't know. I just love the visuals in movies.
Oh, I loved. Yeah.
Cinematographer Hoyt Van Hoytema. I'm sorry, I definitely did not say that correctly. I really appreciate his work because IMAX cameras are not small. They are very large and they are very heavy. And I saw a lot of footage of him in the special features running around with that shit strapped to his shoulder. And like, it really comes across in the film itself, how much effort he put into it, because it looks great, but also a lot of the shots are like sweeping and like, really mobile, and a huge fan of that, because like, I can't think of many IMAX movies where there's a lot of like kinetic motion, you know, where they're like, you're following shit, like the opening sequence in the opera house. That shit's great, and it's like invigorating, and you're like, you're already in the moment. You're watching the SWAT dudes running down the hall, and it's like, god, it's huge. Everything just feels so huge in the movie, and it's god, it's just super friggin' successful. And it's really nice to see a fresh, new idea that isn't connected to a former property, that isn't connected to another franchise or something like that. And I know that's probably such a tired thing to say now, you know, like everyone is saying that, but it's like,
yeah,
oh, it's just, thank you. Thank you so much for a fresh script. Considering we have to wrap this up shortly, I am going to end it on one thing, regarding what Tenet could have done better.
Oh, yes.
Tenet could have been a better movie if it was the kind of spy movie with Vin Diesel playing Xander Cage in XXX.
Where did we?
That's about it.
What is it that he says when he's talking to the interview lady that he's like uncomfortably attracted to? Now I have to quote it. He during an interview to the lady would keep saying like, "God, you're so beautiful. God, she's so beautiful. Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, look at her. How am I supposed to do this interview?"
That's so disgusting.
Tell me your story. Let's get out of here. Let's go. Let's go have lunch. My God, I love her. Guys, really, look how beautiful she is. You guys think this is a joke? How am I supposed to sit here when I'm looking at such beauty? She's so beautiful. I'm in love. I'm in love with the interviewer.
Oh, my God. Stop. I hate that.
He just kept going. It was terrible. It was...
Yeah, clearly. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Thank you for making me remember that at the end of this whole thing.
Yeah, thank you for reading it ad nauseum. Appreciated that.
Are we going to have to end each episode with a Vin Diesel quote now?
Oh, fuck.
Yes. Yes.
All right, well, let me do this. As always, I'm Zane.
I'm Vin.
All right, this has been Diesel Your Heart Out. And like I always say, guys... I'm one of those boys who appreciates a fine body regardless of the make.
I gotta go. Bye.